You're listening to the Jason Greger Show, presented by PlayAlberta.ca. Play in Alberta, everything stays in Alberta. Revenues from Play Alberta stay in the province. It can help get the Henday built. Kevin, just as everybody predicted, at the end of the regular season, Sergei Bobrovsky would be dominating in the playoffs.
Didn't even start the playoffs, right?
No.
Didn't even start the playoffs. And yet, you know, it reminds me a little bit, and others have made the comparison, so I'm not trying to be first here by any stretch, like the year that Hopi lost his starting job, right? And watched Philip Grubauer play the first couple of games, lose the first couple of games. And Hopi's a guy that had won a Vezina trophy at that point in his career and comes off the bench. And we're not there yet, but goes all the way. And certainly Bob is on a heater like Braden got on in that year. And, you know, it's funny because to me the questions that arise from watching it aren't how is he doing this, because it all looks very familiar. In terms of the technical elements of his game, the pace at which he's able to play, the speed, the power, the movements, like all that's always been there. So the question to me when I watch this isn't how is he doing this? It's how are the numbers so pedestrian up until this point? Like how did you go that long? You know, at times, and we talked about this even last season going into playoffs, like, you know, below expected in terms of you know, save percentage and goals saved, like not even playing up to league average. And all those tools, physically and mentally, clearly were all there. So that's the question I'm left asking myself more so than how's he doing this now. It's like, what the hell happened for the last couple of years? Like where was this? Where did this go? Why couldn't he deliver it consistently? And you know, I think part of it has to do with the coaching change. You know, and this one I don't have an answer to, but let me throw this one at you. We talked a lot about Paul Maurice with Connor Hellebuck in Winnipeg, and we talked about Connor Hellebuck's strengths and relative weaknesses. Again, relative. He's one of the best goalies in the world. But his strength is if you attack him in straight lines, there's nobody better. And relative to that, if you go east-west, the numbers fall off a cliff. And when Maurice was there, and actually, you know, Rick Bonus, so maybe this is just, hey, in general, teams don't want to give up lateral plays, but especially when Maurice was there. Like, I remember shorthanded when other teams were on the power play, they would just let guys walk in. And it would look like the most glorious chance, but it was what they would give up with to avoid giving up a lateral. And as long as it was in straight lines, Hellebuck ate it up. Like, he understood the idea that if you come at me in a straight line, and the closer you get, the smaller the net is behind me relative to the space I'm occupying. He understands that better than anyone. And here we are when I look at the numbers on Bob those first couple of years. And I remember mentioning this with you, like just getting killed on plays into the mid and sort of upper end of the low slot, like plays into the front of the net, just below the hash marks, face-off dot to face-off dot, just getting killed on those plays for his first few years in Florida. You tell me, when was the last time you saw a scoring chance from there in these playoffs?
Yeah, no, hey, they. I will say Bobrovsky, though, like his saves on Aho yesterday, a few of them, I was just like, oh, my goodness. Like his ability to go side to side with his blocker now, and, you know, even he releases his stick, and I was reading an article, I think it was Mike McKenna talking about how, you know, they work on that because if you let your stick go, you can get more extension, and it's not throwing your stick, but some could argue maybe it's bordering on it, so we'll see.
No, but, dude, we had articles on this at Ingle over the years. Like, they practice it. They used to do it on two-on-ones, like the idea that, you know, a lot of goalies, and the thing that, this is the one, here's one that I don't understand. So in the first round of the playoffs, he gave up like 8 goals on the blocker side. And we saw it early against Toronto. I remember Elliot Friedman highlighted it on hockey night, and he actually sent me a note asking about the numbers. And yeah, sure enough, like 8 blocker side goals in the first round, more than any other goalie and all those things. But I looked at my historical numbers, and I'm like, man, like that first round is a blip to me. That is not how things have tracked against him historically in terms of the blocker being a weakness. As a matter of fact, it's always been a relative strength. And part of that is, Lundqvist talked about this. Again, we've had articles on it at Ingle where he uses a very tapered, what we call a slope shoulder pattern on the paddle, the top where the shaft intercepts the paddle on the stick where the hand goes, so that he can really choke down on it and get that blocker turned and square. See a lot of goalies where their blocker will sort of almost be facing the sideboards, and what faces the shooter is the inside edge of the blocker wall. He does a lot of different things to prioritize blocker coverage and the ability to square up and activate his blocker. And so it never made sense to me. And Toronto did, especially in those first couple games. Like, Matthews had great looks, and he always went after the blocker. And it felt like it was too often to be a coincidence. And I said at the time it didn't feel like a smart strategy to me based on history. And sure enough, it's kind of translated that way. Now everybody's sort of catching on. Like, in instances where other goalies will turn that blocker and not get it square on the face, he's always sort of got it facing the shooter and presenting squared up to the shooter. And then the dropping of the stick, whether it's a two-on-one or a play like last night, he got caught fishing. It's one of the things that you can actually try and target. He likes to poke check. He's been really good breaking up plays with his stick. He's really effective, especially coming off his blocker side. But the one area you can target is if he reaches across on his glove side, just like that chance, it delays your ability to get back. And he barely did on that Aho chance. And again, like you pointed out, if my stick is in my hand, it slows me down. And by dropping that stick, it frees up that blocker. There's no more stick interference. So just get out there and make a save, almost like you would with your glove, like totally unencumbered. A lot of goalies prioritize their stick placement over their blocker placement, not Bob. And so, in matter of fact, on two-on-ones, not only did they use, I used to watch this, it's not just that they would practice dropping the stick on certain situations, and Ian Clark still works on this with the goalies here in Vancouver, but on odd man runch chances, they would practice the placement of the stick, trying to leave it in the middle of the ice so that if the guy on the other end of that pass tried to go back the other way, there was a chance it would hit the stick while it's headed over. So these are all details in his game that have always been there. But clearly, as you said, I mean, he's on a heater. He is executing them all to the nth degree right now.
Kevin Woodley joins us at Sports Center, TSN 1260. You look to the West game tonight. Ottinger, it's been a close series, of course, both games going into overtime. Dallas losing both in overtime. What does Dallas need to do better in attacking Aiden Hill in this series?
Yeah, I think they almost got to go try and get a little higher in the zone. It reminds me of some of the things we talked, like put him into a reaction zone. There are similarities to Skinner, because remember we talked about this a little bit, like anything down tight and around the net, and it's for different reasons, but in a similar fashion, like he's really good inside. In Hill's case, he plays a really neutral depth. Student from now Sean Burke, the goalie coach there, a lot of what you used to see out of Mike Smith. Maybe not. It's not quite as extreme. It's not camped out on the goal line, but you're rarely going to see him above half ice, maybe two-thirds up his crease. Like he is not playing in the white. He is always in the blue and pretty conservative at that. And it's a philosophy that obviously Sean Burke, you know, learned under Benoit Lair, and you know a lot of his goalies have sort of played this way. And Aiden Hill's a guy that is having a lot of success with it. When you're attacking him, though, like you got to sort of understand, like you still want to go east-west, but his numbers east-west slot line plays, we call them, below the hash marks, low slot line plays, which is one of the biggest increases in offense in the NHL over the last 5 years of those types of plays. Aiden's actually remarkable at defending them, and part of that is, you know, he's got length in terms of that frame and his ability to extend those legs and seal the ice. But it's also just the depth he plays with. It's a shorter path for him. He gets there easier because he doesn't have to go as far. And where his numbers fall off significantly in comparison is the same type of plays across the middle of the ice, across the slot line, but above the hash marks, where you force him to do a little bit more skating, one-timers on the other end of it. And I think, you know, like those are small details, but like, you know, you hope that's something that's being emphasized. Because you don't get a lot of odd man rushes at this point in the playoffs, but how you attack when you do is important. And so, just like some goalies, you know, I remember having this conversation with Holtby. He would rather you force a guy to make that pass really in tight, close to him, because he felt like that guy, all he could do was redirect it. If you'd get a pad there and maybe build a glove over top of it, that's all you had to do. I think with Hill, you need to put him in more of a reaction zone, make him use his hands a little bit more by making sure you try and complete those plays and those passes and get those shots off from above the hash marks rather than in tight. The one thing the Oilers did really well that I haven't seen enough yet from Dallas is, as good as he is down low in tight, some of the post-play habits are still a little sloppy. That's probably too harsh a term, but you know, that's where you can get him opening up and reaching. And once he does, and he's into scramble mode, you know, it takes a couple of those chances before you sort of get him reaching and opening up and not keeping that seal along the ice. We even saw, you know, in the tying goal, the Ben goal in late in game one, where, you know, he reaches across with the pad, but he doesn't have the extension. And because he reaches rather than pushing through his knee, reaches with the toe, he loses his seal in the pad. That actually goes right underneath the bottom section of his pad, which is, you know, frankly, looking back at it, not a goal you want to give up. You want that lower portion sealed. So if you can create scrambles, broken play type opportunities in front, and I think your best chances to do it from below the goal line and around the goal line, make him move in and out of his post, that's an area where, as good as he is in tight normally, you can get him sort of, you know, for lack of a better term, flailing. We used to talk about Mike Smith falling forward, right? There's an element of that when he gets in those situations in tight.
Kevin Woodley joins us. I'm the Sports Leader, TSN 1260. I'm not even sure it matters to talk about Carolina's goaltender at this point, because I just think the series is over. And it's not a knock on their goaltenders. It's just, you know, Bobrovsky's been better, and I don't think that it really matters. Florida's scored just enough to win. So I do want to get your thoughts, Kev. We had this question asked to us earlier about, you know, where Canadian goaltenders are overall compared to the rest of the world, you know, Europe, USA, etc. Is it just that right now Canada's in a little bit of a downtime? I got some good young Canadian goaltenders, but obviously, you know, there's not the Waugh's and the Brodeurs and the Josephs and, you know, heck, you go to Carey Price, etc. You know, Marc-Andre Fleury's near the end of his reign in the National Hockey League. So is it just cyclical, or are you seeing any concerns as to why Canadian goaltenders aren't right now on level as the rest of the world?
I mean, listen, part of it is cyclical. Part of it is you'll never see the advantage that we had, you know, in the era of the Waugh's and Brodeurs, where it was all coming out of Quebec and nobody else knew how they were doing it. Like those days are over, right? There aren't many secrets left in terms of how you do things, how you develop, how you coach. I will say that, you know, as a nation, the way we coach goaltending, just because it's the private industry, right? Like, everything is private. There's no sort of national goaltending development plan to guide that. And I think there are times where, like, there are excellent coaches working within that system. I mean, excellent, world-class. But there are times where I think that the nature of that can be a negative compared to the more sort of, you know, nationally organized coaching curriculums that we see in other countries. Now, that's not to say they're perfect either, right? Like, there was a stretch there in the Swedish curriculum where, you know, there were a lot of people that would look at it and argue that it was too systematic, that they were creating goalies who all played the same, looked the same, and maybe lacked a little instinct, played a little too structural. So, you know, there's no definitive answer. I do think that, you know, it's fair to say, at least in terms of having guidelines and some structure in place to create more support for young goalies at the grassroots level without having to spend a fortune, we have fallen behind. We have not done enough to support volunteer goalie coaches, volunteer parents, the ones that go out with little Johnny and little Susie when they're 7 or 8 or 9 years old, whether they're full-time goalies or not. And that's another debate we could have. There's way too many full-time goalies at too young an age in Canada.
Thank you.
Some people make that argument. But when they are out there, you know, frankly, they don't always have the coaching. Again, you'll have organizations that'll bring in private coaches to work with the association. But there's something to be said, and this is what the other countries do. They create, you know, I look at the Swedes, I look at the Finns, like, they didn't go out to create an army of goalies. They went out and they deliberately tried to create an army of well-educated goalie coaches right down to the grassroots volunteer levels, so that when those kids are out there, they're getting instruction that actually translates and not just challenge the shooter, cut down your angle, stand up more, right? Like, yeah. There's some actual thought process into it. And sometimes that thought process is understanding that we don't want to get technical. We don't want to be teaching a 9-year-old to reverse VH. Because you're just doing damage to their hips and putting them in a position they can't actually fill the net. You know, so there are a lot of, and I got to be careful here, because there are a lot of excellent coaches in Canada. Just a lot of them are on the private side. And you know, that in a sport that's already crazy expensive and a position that's even more expensive than shooters and defensemen, forwards and defensemen have to face, it's an extra layer of barrier to excellence.
So, Kev, you mentioned that there's too many full-time goalies. So it hurts because they're not understanding. Because I remember I had Sean Burke on the show many years, and he said he really encouraged goalies to play out so they'd understand what the roles of those other players are. So when they play goal, they would know, oh, the defenseman's going to be here, the defenseman's going to be there, and they could react to that. But also, is it if we have too many full-time goalies, we might have some kid who could be good, but he never gets a play goal, or she never gets a play goal, yeah. So you never know if they're any good.
Yeah, 100%. Like, it's a bit of both, right? Like, It's some of the best we've produced over the last little while, right? Like, you look at a Braden Holtby, right? His dad was a goalie in the WHL. What's the first thing he made sure Braden did? Played out till 12 or 13. Understood the flow of the game, the reads of the game. We talk a lot about, and I hate the term, but the reality is it's true. Goalie school goalies. They get out there in drill situations, and I'll have NHL goaltenders, Jason, be like, I can't believe how well these 12 and 13-year-olds move. They move better than me. And a lot of them do. But do they process and read and understand the game? And a lot of times they don't. And part of that is, like, at a certain age, you can get away, especially if you're bigger than your peers at that age. Yeah. You can just move to the right spot, be there, and get hit. Do we teach them how to read the game? Do we teach them how to process the game? Do we teach them how to skate properly? Or do they get away with just being big and dropping? That's why I think a lot of the really big kids at a younger age that always tend to move up, like, they can, life can be a little easier for them. And then when things get harder, they haven't developed that ability to read a release properly, right? They just, because for so long they've gotten away with just filling that space. And so, you know, we just had Sean's son, Brendan, on the, because he's now coaching goalies down in Arizona and he works with the Portland Winterhawks, and, you know, talking about these same things, how his dad wouldn't let him just be a goalie at a young age. We had him on the podcast at InGoal, and just tons of great insights into that. And, you know, he saw some holes in the development models as well, like even language, right? Like, we hear that all the time, and at the NHL level, maybe there's some truth to it, but nothing through you, right? We hate the five-hole goals because it went through you. Well, if you tell a kid nothing through you all the time from a very young age, and we all groan and the bench groans when a kid gives up a five-hole goal, what are you creating? You're creating a kid that's going to default to his knees and make sure he doesn't give up that goal anymore. Well, now he's no longer protecting the perimeters of the net. And as they get better and the age moves up and the skill of the shooters is constantly increasing, he's not going to be able to make those saves around the perimeter that will be the difference maker, the high glove, the over the shoulder, because he won't have developed the patience because everybody's been yelling at him, nothing through you, and groaning when a five-hole goal goes in. We got to accept those goals sometimes and watch how we talk about them, the language we use. And five-hole goals is just one example of many. But it's, you know, it's that give and take of the position that makes it special. And I think sometimes the people that are working with goalies at a young age, whether it's mostly, like, you know, again, not educated on goaltending, they reinforce some of those negative stereotypes that, you know, are bad for, I'm not saying that's going to make or break a kid necessarily, but it sure doesn't help. And it's bad for goaltending development overall in the country. Even if it's just one example, it's one we see all the time.
Kev, great stuff, my man. We got lots to talk about in the offseason. Enjoy Bobrovsky, because by next Monday we'll likely be knowing who's in the Cup final, or maybe it'll already be started. So we'll talk about it then.
One team could be on their fourth stringer, and the other one could be on the $10 million guy who didn't start. If I could figure this out, Jason, I'm telling you, man, like, I'd be able to punch my ticket here. Nobody can figure this out.